Today on Against the Grain, while much of the American West burns, where should leftists struggle in order to halt the worst effects of global warming? Kristen Parenti believes, since time is in short supply, that we have no choice but to use the existing institutions of the U.S. state. And to do that, he argues, we should draw lessons from an unexpected source, Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers of the United States. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What possible bearing could Alexander Hamilton have on the fight against global warming? In Radical Hamilton, Economic Lessons from a Misunderstood Founder, published by Verso, Kristen Parenti takes a fresh look at the legacy of Alexander Hamilton, the architect of the U.S. financial system, with that question in mind. Kristen Parenti teaches economics at John Jay College, part of the City University of New York, and joins me now. Let me get the obvious question out of the way, which is, why would a radical like you want to rehabilitate one of the founding fathers of the United States, one of the most noxious forces in the world?
Well, to some extent, it happened by mistake because I stumbled upon this document, the report on manufacturers written by Hamilton, and noticed that the way it was discussed by American historians indicated that they really didn't read it. And it sounded like a kind of like a statist developmentalist document that was totally at odds with free market economics. And that seemed like a major contradiction in the story. And so it was in pursuing that I got into this whole project. But why, at a more macro level, what might be the utility for, you know, I wouldn't say I'm trying to rehabilitate the guy, and I'm sort of not interested in Hamilton the person. That's less important than the political economy of that moment of the American Revolution, the critical period that followed it, and the American Constitution. And I think that the kind of the use of returning to that and looking at it from a left perspective is, among other things, that it reveals how American capitalism from the very beginning had built into it already lots of planning, lots of socialistic features of government. That the idea that what we need to do now in the face of the climate crisis is some huge departure from the way that American capitalism has developed is to some extent wrong. We need to make massive changes and completely change direction. But the idea that government intervening in the economy and, you know, planning to achieve an economic transformation, in our case, it would be getting off fossil fuels. Like, at one level, this strikes many Americans as totally alien. Like, well, government taking on this sort of role. And what I discovered is that, of course, government has been doing that in all sorts of unhelpful ways all along in the modern era, bailing out banks, this and that. But actually, it goes all the way back to the beginning. The Industrial Revolution in the United States and elsewhere was driven by state policy. So that I found sort of hopeful because it implies that the developmentalist state, a state that will guide economic transformation and deliberately plan and direct an economy towards a desired outcome, this is not a new alien thing. This is how this economy developed. So if we're serious about a green reindustrialization, euthanizing the fossil fuel industry, totally fundamentally transforming how we do agriculture, building out a whole new clean energy and technology sector. If we're serious about that, that is essentially a project of green reindustrialization. Well, how would we do that? Well, we could do worse than looking at how the original industrialization of this country happened. And it happened not through the market being left alone and the genius of entrepreneurs taking risks, but actually it happened with massive amounts of government subsidy, public ownership, protective tariffs, massive research in research and development, strategic purchasing and protection of raw materials, and all of this used not willy-nilly, but all of this subordinated to a vision and a plan and consistently pursued in concert. So that's why.
For those of us who've forgotten our American history, Can you give us a brief biographical sketch of who Alexander Hamilton was?
Yeah, so he's born in the island of Nevis. He is orphaned at around age 13. He goes and works for a local shipping company, and he begins writing articles for the local island press, and some of the notables there recognize that this guy is really smart, and they take up a collection to send him off to a year of boarding school and then college at what's now Columbia University, but was then King's College. So he arrives in the U.S. in around 1754 or 5 and does that 1 year of high school, as we would call it, and then is enrolled in King's College just as the Revolutionary War is really heating up. So in Massachusetts, the fighting, so the Boston Tea Party is, 1773, that's sort of like direct action is beginning. And then by 1775, shooting has begun in April 1775 with at Concord and Lexington. And so through 75 into 76, there's fighting in Boston. The Continental Army forms. The colonies, the 13 colonies, come together and declare their independence and create the Articles of Confederation, which is their sort of proto-constitution. And by March 76, the British have left Boston and Washington heads down to New York, and then the British, who fall back to Nova Scotia, then come and they invade Staten Island and use that as a base to attack New York City, which Washington is trying to defend. And so in the meantime, while all that's happening, Hamilton is in college, writing, getting a name as a pamphleteer, and beginning military training. Many of the students start forming militia companies, and he's commissioned in 76 as an artillery officer in the Continental Army. And so he then serves under Washington on the front lines as an artillery officer and basically is busy for a year guarding the retreat of the Continental Army as it's pushed out of Brooklyn, up out of Manhattan, across the Hudson, down into New Jersey, down through New Jersey, down into Pennsylvania in a series of defeats. And Hamilton was he was an impressive character, though I'm not, as I say in the book, I don't want to side with him. I don't want to personalize it too much. I'm interested in his political economy. That said, he was a very unusual person. He was, obviously really brilliant and good at everything he did. And he was a well-liked and capable officer. And so he's being courted by various generals to join their staff, and he holds out until he gets an invitation from Washington to join Washington's staff. So that's in the early part of early summer of 1777. He leaves the front lines and he goes and by joining Washington's staff, or what Washington called his family, Hamilton then becomes a kind of military bureaucrat or military planner, right? And instead of, rallying the men and being brave and thinking in terms of tactics and strategy, he becomes much more concerned with the political economy of how you keep food in the mouths of soldiers and where you're going to get paper to write orders on and how you deal with these 13 different crews of frequently uncooperative, self-involved elites in the 13 states. And so he has this bird's eye view of a war that is profoundly dysfunctional as an economic project. And that's when his political economic thinking really begins to develop. His early writing, he sounds a lot like everybody else who's writing, which is, kind of influenced by John Locke. And it's like, about personal liberty and the need for freedom from this overbearing monarchy. But then once he's in the military, he's starting to think much more about, well, how do you actually make a project like this work? What has to happen materially for this whole experiment to survive and function? And it's not just having good rhetoric, and it's not just being moral, and it's not just being brave on the battlefield. It's like you've got to have a financial infrastructure and a productive infrastructure, and you have to have foreign relations that will support the effort, i.e. the nascent state has to have good credit internationally so that it can borrow, so that it can produce and procure, so that it can fight, so that it can manage, and so that it can defend its sovereignty. And all these lessons start being driven home experientially.
So then would it be fair to say that Hamilton's vision and how he thought of the role of the state was very much shaped by dislocation and crisis, by war, but also the enormous upheavals, which I hope you can enumerate, that were taking place in the 1780s?
Yes. One thing I discovered, I think, hidden in plain sight, is that it seems like he has a nervous breakdown. In the fall of 1777, going into 78, there's finally a victory at Saratoga. A British army is coming down from Canada and is intercepted by General Horatio Gates. Washington is in Valley Forge, sort of blocking, protecting Congress, which has fled Philadelphia. Philadelphia is occupied by the British, and Washington needs some reinforcements and some supplies. Things are pretty rough. Horatio Gates defeats and captures his army and all of its equipment, and suddenly starts going rogue and starts planning his own operations against New York. And there's another general up there named Putnam who's doing the same thing. And Hamilton is sent up to intervene and to get these two generals to come to heel and to share some of the supplies and to stick with the program. He manages to do this. He's only 23 and he's up there basically alone. He manages to get some, you know, reinforcements and supplies sent down to Valley Forge. And then he has a breakdown, which is described as a nervous fever in which he's delusional and ranting and raging. And he convalesces for 2 months in the home of a civilian. And I mean, the descriptions really do sound like some sort of psychological break. And after that, when he returns to Valley Forge in early 1778, his writing is totally different. It's like outpour through a series of letters to various political and economic players in the colonies. He pours out these letters where he essentially sketches out what will become, you know, the idea of the Constitution, the idea of a central bank, and really his whole vision of a what social scientists would now call a fiscal military state, a sort of centralized modern fiscal military state that can print money, that can borrow money, that can tax to pay off its debts, that has the capacity to invest and even own productive assets, and can drive forward an economic transformation that will produce more wealth than an agrarian, an industrial transformation, that will produce more wealth than an agrarian economy, and thus have the finances to defend itself. So that stuff starts after that breakdown. And then the war as an economic event is interesting. At one level, it's very destructive. You know, I mean, whole towns are burnt by the British, not that many, but some, like what's now Falmouth, Maine, is, you know, burnt to the ground. American shipbuilding, which was a pretty important industry because there was so much cheap timber in the U.S. There was a lot of shipbuilding. People would build ships and then load them up with exports and take them to the Mediterranean and Europe and make a circuit and then sell the ships in the UK and then come back and build another ship. And so all of that stops. Numerous workshops are burnt down. So there's a way in which war is a fetter on production and the economy. But on the other hand, war is a huge stimulus. There's suddenly these, you know, three ravenous armies, the Continental Army, the British Army, and then the French get involved. And the British and the French bring in lots of hard currency with them. The Continental Army is printing money, just basically nearly worthless money, Continental dollars, and issuing IOUs to procure fodder and salt and weapons and gunpowder. And so production booms. There had been, for example, no real salt industry in the colonies because it was used as ballast in ships that were importing finished goods from the UK. And that basically retarded the development of a salt industry. So, and salt is essential for not just flavoring food, but I mean, least of all flavoring food, but for curing food and also for the well-being of animals. And everything is being hauled by animals, right? You know, ravaged cannon. In the book, I give the list, but it's like small cannons require 4 horses, large cannons, 12 horses. And these animals, even if they have enough fodder and food, if they don't have enough salt, they're just useless. So salt production explodes. Iron manufacturing explodes. An arms industry develops. Textile industry is emerging, not at a factory level. This is all happening kind of at the level of small workshops. So during the war, there's this inflationary economic boom. There's just enormous amounts of economic demand. With the end of the war, all of that comes to a screeching halt. And the economy, so the war officially, the peace is signed in 1783, but the majority of the fighting in the Northeast is over by 1780, and the war sort of shifts to the South. And so in the 1780s, the economy plunges into what we now realize was a recession that was as bad as the Great Depression. There wasn't much systematic record keeping. Many records have been destroyed. So it's taken a couple generations of economic historians sort of piecing together ledgers from here and there to actually kind of create data sets to give the overall picture of a macroeconomic condition. And we now realize that, consumption plunges, unemployment increases, prices which had been rising in an inflationary spiral during the war collapse, and there's actually a deflationary spiral sets in, which is bad because it means that investors are reluctant to invest. If money keeps gaining value, why risk money by throwing it into production? So there's this contraction, and this whole crisis in the 1780s is known as the critical period. At the same time, the political structure is that the Articles of Confederation are still the document holding these 13 colonies together. Vermont is not yet recognized as a state. It's a contested part of New York, but it's operating as a kind of autonomous unit. There is no central bank. There's no central currency. Their states are producing money. Private banks produce their own money and banknotes. There's foreign currency. Vermont mints copper coins. Newspapers are publish these complicated ledgers to help merchants try and figure out what the real exchange values are between all these multiple currencies. The former colonies, now states, are essentially sovereign, and many of them start imposing tariffs on each other. New York, for example, really throws its weight around, much to the detriment of merchants and manufacturers in Connecticut and New Jersey. And there's rising commercial tension. The states are also trying to pay off their debts. That Congress, which is the only national body along with the Continental Army produced by the Articles of Confederation, Congress has incurred many debts, but so too have the states. And the states are trying to pay these off. Many of these state debts have been accumulated in the hands of gangs of speculators. So the trying to pay down the debts also engenders a kind of class antagonism. Many of these debts were incurred in the form of IOUs paid to, Teamsters or small manufacturers or farmers who were supplying the Continental Army or state militias. And frequently the working productive middle classes who receive these IOUs, fearing that they will soon be worthless, get rid of them at a discount, a fraction of their face value, and speculators buy them up. So there's the process of trying to extract money from the economy to pay down these debts, and then it's also these speculators who are benefiting from that. There's all sorts of violence up and down the frontier. In Georgia, white settlers are in conflict with Creek Native Americans, Cherokee in what's now Eastern Tennessee, the Shawnee are in continual sort of sporadic conflict with white settlers in Kentucky. And so this whole, particularly in what's now Kentucky and Ohio, there's what will become a major war with Native American nations that will come to fruition later in the 1790s and involve some of the worst defeats that the American Army has ever undergone. But so there's all this kind of violence developing. There's military conflict against self-emancipated African-Americans, formerly enslaved people who have escaped slavery and set up maroon colonies. And some of these people had served with the British Army because the British Army were recruiting slaves, enslaved people to escape. And they were promised their freedom if the men and families would fight. You know, everyone could come and meet the British and, you know, join the British lines. But the condition was the men would have to fight. And so there were, you know, several thousand African-American, formerly enslaved people who served with the British. Many of them are evacuated, go to Nova Scotia, and then found Sierra Leone, but some are left behind. And so they're part of these maroon communities in Georgia and Savannah. There's a sort of small maroon war going on down there. There's conflict between rival groups of white settlers in eastern Tennessee, again, at that time it's part of North Carolina, and the settlers on the frontier are don't want to be controlled by the elites in lower North Carolina. They're planning to create their own state, the state of Franklin. They attempt to secede. There's a couple of actual, you know, battles around that, along with all sorts of other sort of just, you know, low-level hostilities and fistfights and murders and stuff like that. In the Wyoming Valley of Pennsylvania, there's a similar conflict. There's a group of settlers who are backed by speculators, land speculators based in Philadelphia, who are sending settlers into the Wyoming Valley. And then there's a rival group of New England-based settlers, New England Yankees, who are being backed by Connecticut-based speculators. And this gives way to what's called the Yankee-Pennamite War that involves a number of pretty vicious firefights and, burnings of whole villages and rapes and murders. And, things are just escalating. And the Yankees down in the Yankee-Pennamite War recruit Ethan Allen, who's a hero of the Revolutionary War and a hero delivers Vermont, which is for 10 years an independent state, delivers it its sovereignty, essentially. And so, you know, this whole thing is threatening to heat up. And all of this then culminates with Shays Rebellion. At the same time, in the background, there are two major volcanic eruptions in 1783. There's a massive volcanic eruption in Japan and a massive, like, year-long series of volcanic eruptions in Iceland. And this has the effect throughout the latter part of the 1780s of creating a cooling effect over the Northeast, particularly in New England. And there's really, really wet, cold summers. Crops fail. There's lots of flooding. So there's an environmental crisis. Onto this comes, you know, this effort to continually pay down these debts is building and building. Congress, which doesn't have the power to actually tax, but has to make requests, essentially, from the states, requests this a massive tax collection, the requisition of 1785. And this is being collected throughout 1786. And so this is like, you know, the culmination of the critical period, this mini climate crisis, this debt crisis, and the culmination of this whole process in crisis is Shays Rebellion in Western Massachusetts.
Christian Parenti is my guest. He is the author of Radical Hamilton, Economic Lessons from a Misunderstood Founder. That's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What you're describing, which was absolutely formative to the thinking of Alexander Hamilton and the sort of political economy that he saw that you zero in on in Radical Hamilton, was this period of absolute crisis. And that period of crisis culminated with Shays Rebellion. Tell us about that.
So Shays Rebellion, you know, there's this cooling period and crop failures, and there's this massive tax requisition, and farmers are unable to pay their taxes, and they're going into foreclosure. And this is in Western Massachusetts. And so to resist these foreclosures, they start organizing themselves into what they call regulators. And Daniel Shays, for whom the name is one of their leaders, but there are other leaders, and they call themselves not Shaysites, but regulators. And they start shutting down the courts. They just say, you know, the judges and the lawyers can get out of here. You're not going to foreclose. The state authorities call up the militia to put an end to this, because these are protests, but it's like they're kind of like protests today. It's like a lot of armed people in these protests, but they're not only sort of like peaceful protests. And there's some of these similar protests going on in Connecticut and in New Hampshire. And in, so in Massachusetts, they call up the militia, and the militia, again and again, either switches sides or just refuses to get involved, and they just melt away. So the elites on the coast take up a collection, and they hire a private army. And in the winter of 1786 going into 87, this army goes after the regulators, the Shaysites. And there are two fairly major battles, and the Shaysites are headed through a snowstorm to attack the federal armory in Springfield, Massachusetts, and looted of its weapons. And they're cut off in the middle of the night and ambushed by this elite-backed private army. And they're defeated, and they have to, the Shaysites have to fall back into Vermont, where they're supported by Ethan Allen and Governor Chittenden, and then also into New York. And then, and there's like, you know, conflict goes on all through the spring. And so the kind of the last mop-up operations of the Shays Rebellion are going on in May of 1787, just as the Constitutional Convention convenes. And the Shays Rebellion was the capstone of the whole critical period. And it, it is the event that really animates the minds of the political elites of the colonies. And it makes them realize, wait a minute, this whole thing could easily fall apart. We need a better, we need a new constitution. And one of the things that I do in this book is sort of try and problematize the classic description of this conflict as just sort of democracy versus aristocracy. There's a reading, and often a left reading or kind of a liberal reading of this, where it's that the Articles of Confederation are more democratic because the states have more power and localities have more power, and that is assumed to be more democratic, but it's not necessarily more democratic. Many of these states and their state constitutions were highly undemocratic, had very onerous property qualifications on voting, which the federal constitution did not have. It does allow states to continue their own, but there's no property qualifications for federal office. There's no explicit exclusion of women from the federal vote, that kind of stuff. So the idea that the states are necessarily more democratic than this new federal government, I take issue with a little bit. I see it more as a conflict between rival groups of elites. You've got a nationally oriented elite that Hamilton is part of, that's thinking in terms of, you know, geostrategic questions of how does this project, this Republican experiment in government, how does it survive in this international arena, whether these, you know, the Spanish Empire, the French Empire, the British Empire. And then you've got these local elites in South Carolina, Virginia, New York, who are concerned with their own parochial prerogatives about owning slaves, controlling business, extracting their, you know, their cut of the tax haul, et cetera. So the Constitutional Convention is a struggle between these forces and these conflicting forces, and the document it produces is a brokered document. And one of the things that I try to do is read the Constitution as an economic document.
You know, you've been describing enormous amounts of cleavages and fractures going on, a huge period of struggle. There's struggles that you see as sort of incipient class struggle, or could be understood through the lens of class struggle. There are these divisions between elites. And just for us to kind of attempt to wrap our heads around the moment, can you describe the degree to which the United States was becoming capitalist, or was capitalist at that time? How should we understand that, since Hamilton obviously plays a very important role in furthering it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's capitalist in that, you know, the private ownership of the means of production is the dominant form of ownership. But, you know, I mean, labor markets are also still have lots of pre-capitalist features, right? There's apprenticeships, and there's all sorts of sort of unfree labor. There's slavery, though slavery is also under attack. Vermont has outlawed slavery in its constitution. Massachusetts outlawed slavery. New York and Pennsylvania have begun the process of ending slavery. So slavery is being rolled back, but there's also, you know, so between slavery and indenture, there are these very kind of traditional pre-capitalist coercive forms of labor control. So it's, I mean, it's an emerging capitalist economy. The factory doesn't exist yet. It's, you know, manufacturing is done in workshops. The economy is predominantly agrarian. And a lot of these, you've got the plantations in the South, which have been described, I think it was Edmund Morgan who described them as like within capitalism, but not fully of it, I think is the way he puts it, right? So it's like the slave plantations are very much part of an emerging world capitalist economy, but they don't in and of themselves always run along capitalist lines. There's lots of production for use. Similarly, under different property arrangements in the North, the small family farms, they're selling into capitalist markets. They're producing commodities for sale, but there's also a significant amount of production for use, right? So a kind of a subsistence economy exists, both in the North and the South. The plantations had a subsistence economy as well. Plantations raised much of their own food because when the enslaved workers were not producing the cash crops, it made more economic sense to have them produce clothing and food. I mean, bulk cloth would be bought, but then clothing would be made and producing food for the workforce. And this was done outside of the cash nexus, you know, so it's production for use. And similarly, on a different scale, the family farms in the North, a lot of what's going on is production for use. So it's a nascent capitalist economy. And what Hamilton wants to do, and, you know, it's not like the point of this book is not to advocate everything Hamilton did, but much more at a meta level to just look at the role of planning in economic history, since that is just consistently denied and ignored in a lot of American history. So what he wants to do is basically, you know, use government policy to force an industrial revolution in this out of the layer of small artisanal manufacturing that exists, right? The factory doesn't exist, but he's sort of imagining it, and it's beginning to emerge in England. So the first modern factory is often dated to 1784, where Samuel Gregg harnesses a water wheel and has a bunch of like indentured orphans contracted to him, sort of, you know, child slaves working in his cotton mill. But before that, you know, much of commercial textile production was done through the putting out system, where merchants would give fiber to farm families that would then spin it into thread, and then the merchant would come back and buy it back, or in small workshops where a sort of master crafts person would have, you know, 4, 5, 6, or 10 apprentices and sons and daughters working on whatever, you know, making barrel staves or candles or shoes, that kind of stuff. So Hamilton sort of like can sense that there's this huge transformation coming, and he does not want to leave it to the market to do this. He wants to drive it forward. And that involves creating a modern credit system centered on a partially publicly owned bank, and then using all sorts of other government power to drive industrialization.
Tell us about Hamilton's key text, the Report on the Subject of Manufactures, which is frequently abbreviated to the Report on Manufactures. That was published in 1791. What was the context in which it was written, and more importantly, what did he argue in that work?
So Hamilton is crucial at the Constitutional Convention, and he gets, part of what he does is have some important economic planning powers and capacities given to the government under Article 1, Section 8, power to build roads, power to, you know, coin money, to set weights and measures, to invest in R&D, and to govern trade, to basically the right to regulate economic activity. Then once the Constitution is ratified, the Bill of Rights has to be added. The first 10 amendments of the Constitution have to be added to the Constitution to get people to vote to ratify it, because they recognize, wait a minute, we're producing here a very large and powerful central state. That's what this document does. So then Washington is elected, Hamilton is appointed Secretary of the Treasury, and he begins issuing a series of reports that lays out the creation of the First Bank and the Mint, et cetera, et cetera. And then this culminates in how to deal with public lands, which have become very important for how the government, central government, will borrow money from abroad and create the funded debt, a debt that will continually roll over and pay interest, which basically kind of conserve as money. And then finally, on top of this comes the final thing, the magnum opus, a report on manufacturers, in which he lays out his plan to drive industrialization. And the report is not read, even as it's name checked, in part because it opens with this explicit attack on Adam Smith. So I say explicit, it's explicit in the 18th century sense of the word. Weirdly, American writers would quote without citing frequently, and paraphrase. It was not common to say as Adam Smith said, but to euphemistically kind of refer to it, but then quote Adam Smith. So the report begins with an attack on Adam Smith and an attack on laissez-faire, and also an appeal to the South, the interests of the South, which is to say the interests of Southern elites, who are very afraid that this new government will come after their slaves. And they even say this at the convention. John Rutledge of South Carolina basically threatens secession when the issue of limiting the slave trade comes up. So the Southern elites are afraid that this new powerful state, that if it is allowed to drive forward industrialization, that it will become even more powerful. And the interests in the North that oppose slavery will then use this state to come after their prerogatives in the South. So the report kind of tries to placate the South and say, well, look, you know, industrialization will actually benefit the extractive, what we would call the extractive industries and the agrarian industries of the South, and provide more markets and more demand. And then Hamilton lays out what he calls the means proper, which is a term I think should be as common as, you know, checks and balances or divided government. And he, the means proper are essentially the capacity of government to affect economic change and transformation. And he just then runs them down. And it's like protective duties, outright prohibition of rival articles. This is the beginning of what will be known as like import substitution of industrialization, the protection of infant industries. That term comes from the report. It's infant manufacturers is what he says. So the prohibition on the export of certain raw materials, the subsidy of the import of certain raw materials, direct subsidies, which he calls pecuniary bounties, to subsidize the production of key technologies and sectors, prizes for quality and innovation, exemptions from all of the very same, you know, tariffs and taxes that he lays out before when strategically necessary, and the, you know, investment in R&D is a huge part of it. The encouragement of new inventions and discoveries, and also the regulation and inspection of manufactured commodities. And all of them, each one of these things is like pretty boring and wonky. It's like, well, what does that matter? But actually, you add them all up, this is how industrialization happens. This is what the Chinese have been doing. This is what South Korea did. I mean, this is what the U.S. does. It's what the British essentially did, though they kind of were in denial about it. It's what the Germans will then do in imitation of the Americans, what the Japanese will do with the assistance of the Germans once threatened by, in the 1850s, by American and European gunboats. So anyway, this government-based quality control, investment in infrastructure, and the creation of a financial system to, you know, make sure that payments are remitted everywhere. And then his final thing, which does not really come to pass, is actually he proposes a sort of planning board. And that is not followed in the United States, but that becomes an important part of Japanese industrialization and Chinese and South Korean industrialization, to have within the government a ministry or a board that looks at the big picture, that doesn't just use the means proper, these various tools in a haphazard fashion, but comes up with some sort of plan and makes sure that the entire economy is moving more or less in unison towards the desired direction. So the report on manufacturers is not red in this country. It's name checked, but it is actually red in East Asia and understood better there as a kind of a founding document of dire East economics, of state-directed economic development. And that sort of, I wouldn't even call it a third way, but that sort of pragmatic practice of using state power to drive economic change, developmentalism, and that is absolutely essential in the story of industrialization everywhere around the world throughout history. Where there is successful industrialization, there is always a developmentalist state involved and guiding the process. And where there is not an activist state, developmentalist state intervening and attempting to deliberately and consciously transform the economy, you do not have development, you do not have economic transformation, you do not have industrialization. More often than not, you get quote unquote underdevelopment, which isn't the lack of development, but is the maldevelopment of being in either a formal or informal colony in which you accept finished goods at whatever prices the powerful economies offer them at, and you're stuck exporting a low value added agricultural or primary product commodities like ore and timber.
Christian Parenti is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Economics at John Jay College, the City University, and the author of Radical Hamilton, Economic Lessons from a Misunderstood Founder, which is published by Verso. So, as you write in the book, Alexander Hamilton's status vision influenced German industrialization, Meiji Japan, and the East Asian Tigers. And yet, I want to ask you, since you are arguing that we should take that legacy of Alexander Hamilton seriously because of the climate crisis, if we think of him as this perhaps even post-colonial proponent of the developmental state, does that not still land us at the place where critics of South Korean or Taiwanese developmental capitalism might make, which is developing and industrializing one's economy through status means at a time of climate emergency where industrial capitalism has accelerated the harms of global warming, is that a progressive end in itself?
It's not sufficient, but part of what drove me to write this book and embrace developmentalism, as it were, is not some sort of idealism or some like grand vision, but the realization that the time frame of climate change is so compressed that we cannot wait to transform all social relations. We cannot wait to achieve socialism and then try and decarbonize the economy. And we have to start decarbonizing the economy immediately with these institutions and these arrangements. And so it's not that the developmentalist state is not without its problems. It is. It's very often, implemented by very authoritarian regimes. So it would be nice to detach developmentalism from an authoritarian political project. Not that it always coincides with that. But what it is good for is rapid industrial transformation. And that is what we have to do just to buy time in dealing with climate change. And so, what the developmentalist state and excavating the Hamiltonian tradition offers us is not a path to socialism and not a path to a truly just society, but a path to an effective triage and emergency forced march away from the fossil fuel industry. And that project in turn buys us time / lays the groundwork for a broader progressive set of transformations. But there's not going to be any broader socialist project if modernity collapses into, a Hobbesian war of this fascist band against that lunatic religious nationalist, despot. So I think we have a real kind of problem of economic triage, of emergency intervention to try and decarbonize the world economy as quickly as we can. And that cannot wait for a revolution in all social relations. It has to happen now. And I would hope that in the process, that if we can realize that state intervention and getting prices wrong, and, you know, as Alice Amsden put it in her discussion of South Korea, like that South Korea industrialized not because they let the market do its thing and let the market, you know, and the price signal get prices right. But no, she said, the state stepped in and got prices wrong. Said, no, we want a lot of steel produced, so we're just going to make sure that happens. So that in the process of recognizing, okay, we already are dependent on all sorts of subsidies. I mean, the fossil fuel industry is massively subsidized. The Democrats, by the way, refused, or they very quietly took the removal of fossil fuel subsidies out of the platform, the Democratic Party platform, which is itself merely a notional document. But, you know, the fossil fuel industry is not the product of free markets. It's the product of massive grants of access to public lands and public resources and then direct subsidies, right? So step one in dealing with the climate crisis is to realize, okay, there is a developmental state at work here, and we have to change what it is doing immediately, in the form of, you know, cutting off the fossil fuel industry, cutting it off of welfare, no more public lands, no more, you know, welfare for the fossil fuel industry, and then redirect those subsidies elsewhere, but then also come down on them and start taxing and regulating them out of existence. So it's really a limited kind of emergency action that I'm arguing for here. I'm trying to root the necessary emergency planning actions that I think are being forced upon us by climate change. I'm trying to root that in American history. We're trying to excavate how it is rooted in American history, so that the kinds of actions that government is going to have to take and is already taking in the face of climate change don't seem so alien. But like, no, this has always been going on. And in the hopes that that will, to some extent, diffuse the kind of anti-communism and anti-statism that even comes from the left often and muddles our thinking about what kinds of solutions and at what scale are they necessary if we're to deal with climate change.
As much of the West burns in firestorms, the likes of which we have not seen before, which scientists tie to global warming, what do you think, Alexander Hamilton, aside, we should be organizing around, since you have written extensively about the climate crisis, that might force things in the direction that you think are necessary?
Well, I think divestment is really quite ridiculous. And I wrote about this years ago, and then just to be a team player, kind of like didn't harp on about it. But I mean, activists are still pursuing divestment. Divestment does not change actual investment by firms. ExxonMobil has been buying back its stock. So when you get your pension fund to sell their stock, you're not actually stopping oil production. What we need to be doing is demanding that the government, which is already a major player, start to decarbonize itself. There are enormous government fleets of vehicles. They should all be, when possible, and it's not always possible, but when possible, those should be transitioned to electric fleets. Government at the level of towns up through to the states and the federal government all purchase electricity. They should be purchasing electricity from clean, renewable sources. All government buildings should be retrofitted so that they use less energy. We should be making material demands of the material workings of government. The public sector is about a third of the U.S. economy. It can lead the way in decarbonization if it retrofits its buildings, if it transforms its fleets from gas and diesel to electric, and if it starts purchasing its power from wind and solar. And similarly, if it starts supplying schools, and there's some of this has already been going on, supplying schools and other populations with sustainably produced food, right? So there's government procurement is an enormous force in the economy presently, and historically, it has played an enormous role in driving new technologies forward. Government has always been the first generation consumer. This is true with computers, with airplanes, et cetera, et cetera. So I think those are the kinds of demands we need to be making. I think the climate movement needs to shake itself, wake up and get away from this finance fixation that divestment inculcates in people. And activists get deeply involved in the imagination of the fund manager with these divestment campaigns, because it goes divestment and then reinvestment. And then you think that all economic agency happens in the stock market by buying and selling shares. And if you can dump your dirty shares and get shares in some clean company, that you're actually having an impact on economic transformation. And the fact of the matter is, what the clean tech sector needs is customers. It doesn't need parasitic investors to buy the stock of companies that have proven themselves already, right? There's actually generally lots of money for R&D, and when a technology has or a firm using a technology has proven itself in the market, there's usually buyers for its stock, right? But there's what economists call the valley of death in between, or this kind of bringing new technologies to scale. And what's needed there is customers, you know? And so the clean energy revolution can be driven forward if activists start engaging with and demanding that government clean up its own procurement. Government procurement must be made green. If that happens, that would have an enormous knock-on effect throughout the private sector. That's what I think we should be doing. It's something I call cap and buy, right? We should be demanding that government agencies cap their emissions and start buying, cleaning up their procurement, their clean procurement, buying electric vehicles, buying wind and solar generated electricity, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we should be demanding, and that's what we should be going for. And I think we're actually going to see more of that soon. I was actually just approached by someone in the New York legislature who's interested in this sort of stuff. They're realizing that you can move billions of dollars out of fossil fuels, and it doesn't mean that there's more demand for electric cars.
Christian Parenti, we're totally out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Christian Parenti is Associate Professor of Economics at John Jay College. That's the City University of New York. He is the author of 5 books, including Tropic of Chaos and Lockdown America. And we've been discussing his latest book, Radical Hamilton, Economic Lessons from a Misunderstood Founder. That's published by Verso at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.